Hello, everybody. It is September 1st at 9:02 p.m. Eastern Time, and this is the Absolute Ghetto.
Okay. So, first thing we want to do is acknowledge one of our fellow bison making a journey into becoming an ancestor. We want to uplift chat with Bozeman. And did you want to talk about that a little bit? I know that we need to dedicate a lot more time, just a couple of moments, but just a little bit.
All I really want to say right now before we do like a dedicated episode to Chadwick Boseman and his impact is that he is probably the personification of really the concept that we're talking about. He is the ultimate version of like walking in your purpose. Not only like at you like your own purpose, like who you are on the inside, but also connecting that to like the duty that you feel to your people and your race and the struggle. And yeah, it's just so sad that he's no longer with us. Both me and Malcolm have been so devastated. I've been crying for the past 3 days. But we're gonna do an episode on him and just celebrate his life. So let's just do like 10 seconds, moment of silence. Rest in power.
Yes, rest in power.
All right, guys. So, like we said at the beginning, this is the Absolute Ghetto. That's the name of this podcast. This is the first episode. And we are going to explain to you kind of how we decided to name it this for this first episode. We just want to talk about how we came up with the name and when we say the Absolute Ghetto, what we're talking about. So, did you want to start with like how we first experienced the word growing up, Malcolm?
Let's talk about what did ghetto mean to you when you were growing up? Like, what was the definition as you understood it when you were a kid or a teenager?
The ghetto was
Right.
exactly what you did not want to be, where you did not want to go,
Right.
and and what you just did
Right.
not want to experience.
For sure, for sure. That tracks with me too.
In any way,
What
shape,
words
or
I'm
form,
thinking
the
of. Right. It's like poorly put together. It's shoddy. It's going to be a bad time. It's dangerous. It's inferior. It's just, yeah, exactly how you described it, friend.
ratchet.
Like the opposite of what you want to be doing or where you want to be.
But it's also important to note, I think, too, that while the ghetto can represent and sort of mean a lot of things and across the world, and depending on what culture you're talking about, there's different forms of ghettos. Ghettos look different in different countries. But what we're really talking about is ghetto in terms of its connection to Black people and the stereotypes associated with being ghetto in the US. Within the Black American community specifically, and like the Black American hood. So that's sort of the perspective that we're coming from when we say the word ghetto, at least from our childhood and like how we were brought up to like think about ghetto, I think.
So we're gonna get a little bit more into the weeds about that.
Yeah, I did want to talk about a little bit. Well, I feel like it's funny because when I was a kid, I don't remember exactly when I first heard the word ghetto, but I did always associate it with like, Black people, poor Black people, ratchet Black people, the kind of Black people that you quote unquote didn't want to be. But it's funny because I had like friends growing up who sort of co-opted the word and would use it to describe, I guess, just things that were shoddy and sketchy, weird. I had white friends that would use it in a joking manner. Mm-hmm.
But oh, like, no.
But
oh,
yeah.
No, I'm sorry, friend.
And I would like participate too, like because I mean, honestly, it was more like my friends. I didn't start saying this. It was more like my white friends who started being like, "Oh, that's so ghetto."
Wow.
Blah blah blah. And then I would just, I mean, I wasn't like the same person that I am now, like, you know, 10 years ago, obviously. So right. I would just, so I kind of started using it too. I kind of like always in a joking, light manner, and I knew that it was not really like the use of this word in this context is inappropriate. So
yeah. I mean, to me, when I would hear it as a kid and as a teenager, it had a lot to do. Like it had a ability. If you describe something as ghetto, even if it was something that people enjoy, like it kind of robbed it of any dignity. Like I'm thinking about even like way when we got into Howard, and it's like some of these vacation spots became ghetto. You know what I mean? Like it's like people were going. What was that country everyone was going to? It wasn't Mexico. It was another country.
Oh. Wait, Bali?
Yeah, I think it was.
Wait, was it Bali?
And it was like too many black people were going there, and they're like, it's ghetto. Like it's like it done turned into Miami. Because there's, like, a negative, like, Miami's ghetto. It's too many, you know, of the black and brown people there. It's, like, even if it's something that, like, is fun, even if it's something that's good, like, you can't, like, as soon as it becomes more accessible to black people, it's diminished in value. And so that was, like, another way that I heard the word being used, or even, like, when I was a small kid, like, they would say ghetto fabulous a lot. I feel like I heard that a lot, where it's, like, kind of, like, people trying to, like, get that upward mobility, trying to move forward in this capitalistic structure, but they still have, you know, they still carry the hot sauce or whatever. And mm-hmm. it's kind of like a way to like signal that they're not all the way couth. They're not all the way there when it comes to that upward mobility, when it comes to class stratification.
Right. It's like, that's that gourmet, not that gourmet, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
It would be like
y'all don't even know how to spell. Y'all don't even know how to spell prog. That type of sense, you know. Yeah. No, it's no shade. That wasn't shade towards her. Don't. We're not gonna do that.
What you said about like ghetto fabulous. That's interesting because I actually feel like that's a good segue into like how we're starting to conceptualize it instead. And the reason why we called this podcast the Absolute Ghetto is because we really want to talk about Black culture and Black ingenuity and all of its greatness and its power and its innovation.
Yeah. So I am very new to Twitter, but I came across this tweet that I really, really loved. And the tweet said, "Ghetto is nothing but creativity that hasn't been stolen yet." And so it actually is from a writer. Her name is Nazario Scott. I hope I said your name correctly. Mm-hmm. But yes, all of that sentiment completely is how I felt kind of in this journey of like being conditioned and nurtured in this environment where you're constantly rewarded for distancing yourself from your blackness, where you're constantly encouraged, you know, don't speak that way, don't speak to those people, you know what I mean, carry yourself a certain way so that you could be one of the special people who the white people can choose to move up. And kind of like realizing that it's a scam because our people are popping, like our people are awesome,
popping.
Right. Yeah,
and that's that ghetto fabulous. That's the thing. It's like people will mm-hmm. say it like kind of be shady, like, "Oh, she's so ghetto mm-hmm. fabulous," because you know they're saying that she's not really quite there yet. She's not. She's still new money, or she's still not really classy or whatever because she's too ghetto. But really, the absolute ghetto to us is when you embrace like all aspects of your being as a black person, your personality and your own interests and whatever you bring to the table, but still staying true to yourself and your culture and your connection to black people and drawing inspiration from the black people around you and not running from those influences because you feel like, oh, that's not gonna bode well, like, you know, in certain classes or certain rooms and certain events mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, stuff like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, people like People like, oh, Nene Leakes, is that how you say her name?
Yeah,
she's ghetto fabulous, is she not, right? Because,
yeah,
I mean, because even though she's bougie AF, like, when she pulls up to the room, she's still gonna be true to herself, like, she, like, you know, like, blackness, like, just, like, seeps out of her, the way she talks, the way she walks, the words mm-hmm. she uses, the way she dresses. I mean, she'd be wearing Louis Vuitton and all these designers, but the way she puts it together, I mean, she could have walked out of the beauty supply store. You know what I mean? Like, she exudes blackness like that. Like, I mean, she's famous for saying, you know, oh, the ghetto, white refrigerator.
But, refrigerator.
But honestly, like, we kind of want to flip that whole concept on its head and say, hey, Nene, the absolute ghetto, like, you are the absolute ghetto, and we love that about you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because
that's excellence.
Because there's just so much power in who we are, and like learning to center yourself. Because that idea that we all need to be the same, that there's a right way for us to be, is ahistorical. And I'm definitely gonna get into that a little bit later. When we get into more depth and some of the stuff we prepare for y'all. But I feel like going throughout life, you start to see how, specifically within the Black American experience, that we always are creating. We always are ahead of the curve, you know what I mean? And so it's like you're actually who people are copying. You're actually the one who is pushing culture forward, who is pushing knowledge forward, who is pushing people forward. And it's ludicrous to me for us to be down on that, to like think that it's less than. I feel like we're doing a disservice to ourselves, and we're doing a disservice to our fellow humans, because we all need to be bringing our full selves so that we can escape kind of like, that's the thing with why I don't think there's anything inherently wrong at all with white people, but because of this white supremacist construct, a thing that is done to all of us is kind of limit our imagination, is limit our abilities to see beyond certain paradigms, to see beyond the way that things have been, because it's not benefiting a lot of people. And like, Black people have been leading, like, you see the social movement that's happening right now, a lot of the abolition, the calls to defund the police, all that type of stuff is from Black scholarship, is from Black intellectualism. And so, like, we've been thinking about these things. We already have the ideas. Other people, this may be new to them, but Black people have been doing work for a long time. So I don't want to participate any longer in stifling our voice when we have such valuable things to say, when we have things that's going to help everybody. And so that's really what this is all about. Okay, we're gonna take a break. So we talked a lot about like our old conceptions, like in the past, what we thought about ghetto, and specifically what we thought about our relationship to our Blackness. And so I wanted to take some time to talk about like how kind of the journey, well, like first realizing that like what you have been fed, or at least what I have been fed about like how I was supposed to relate to my Blackness and how I was supposed to navigate the world was actually detrimental to my development. And it was actually causing much more harm to me and everyone around me than good. And so, yeah. What's your thoughts, Frank?
I feel like my relationship with this, with my Blackness growing up was complicated. I'm half Nigerian, half Black American. So I had, you know, I kind of have like two different cultural backgrounds. Some of the cultures overlap, but they are pretty two distinct culture, Nigerian culture mm-hmm. and Black American culture. Mm-hmm. So definitely growing up, you know, half African, half Black American was a source of pride for me. Like, I really did love, you know, having like kind of like the best of both worlds, if you could call it that. And I really did love being a Black girl growing up. I feel like where some of the where there was conflict, where friction started to arise, was being in a lot of extremely white spaces growing up. So I went to the Lovett School in Atlanta, Georgia, which is a prestigious, well-known, prestigious white Christian private school. Very vast majority of the student body is white. So I feel like on the one hand, I was constantly having to reaffirm my Blackness in that environment, because I was on the defense every day when I went to school. There was microaggressions, there was little snide comments, I experienced racism, blatant displays of racism, more subdued displays. But I feel like for that reason, I really clung to some of my Black identity, like whether it be my hair or, you know, my skin tone or my features or whatever it may be. Like I showed pride in it. You know, like there was, I remember one time we were reading some African books in our English class, and I offered to the teacher, I said, oh, my dad is Nigerian. This book, you know, this, he could speak to this, and like, you know, maybe he could come in and talk about it. And he ended up coming in and giving the class like a presentation about you know, his journey as as an African immigrant, and he brought in Nigerian food, and so, and that was my
he brought jollof,
he brought goat meat. It was actually really funny, because my friend, one of my best friends, Savannah, she was on the swim team back then, and she had eaten some of the goat meat, and she said she swam her fastest time that day, and she and she had never had goat before, and she had texted me, and she was like, oh my god, like, I had that goat and I swam so fast today, like, I beat all my records. I was like, that, I was like, those ancestors, they show some favor on you,
they empower, yeah.
But so that was on the one hand. Then on the other hand, there was obviously a lot of, you know, low self-esteem that I had associated with, you know, being a Black girl, my experiences being in a lot of white spaces. And obviously I was seeing things that, you know, my white peers would, you know, say or do that would, you know, suggest, you know, that, you know, certain kinds of Black people weren't the kind of Black people that they approved of being around them, or being at this elite school, or being friends with them, you know. So for example, I had, you know, friends that weren't as fortunate as me, you know, who went to this school, and, you know, they it was an expensive school, so, you know, they were on scholarship, but you know, they were definitely treated differently, different situations. I won't get too deep into it, but you know, if there was any inkling of like these young Black girls, you know, not having money, or wearing the same shoes, like, you know, every day for a week, or, you know, just things like that. There, I mean, it was petty, but I definitely was always seeing things that, you know, would reinforce the idea that I was already aware of, that certain kinds of Black people were not the good Blacks, right? Like, those are the ghetto Blacks. Uh-huh. Those are the ratchet Blacks. Those are the Blacks that you don't want to be. And, you know, being in an environment, especially like a high school environment, middle school, high school, I went to Lovett from 5th grade to 12th grade. You just want to be accepted at that age, you know? So you don't want to exude anything that's going to further outcast you. I was already a Black girl, you know? I was already a Black woman at the school, you know? So it was like, I didn't want there to be anything else, you know, that would, you know, ostracize me anymore. So if I saw people getting teased, you know, for certain things, I just wouldn't do them, you know? So that wasn't just like with Blackness, that was like in general. But because so much of that was connected to stereotypical concepts of like Black people and poor Blacks, hood Blacks, ghetto Blacks, I start to associate certain things with the Blacks that I don't want to be like, and consciously make efforts not to act that way, not to be like that, not to be super loud in the cafeteria, for example. Like, a lot of the Black girls would sit together, because Black people stick together in environments like this and in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And there's that book, I had to pull the author, but it's called like Why Do All the Black Kids Sit Together in the Cafeteria?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, really, yeah.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but you know, they do it because the answer is because we have to survive. But anyways, like, they would be loud all the time because I was just like, you know, that's Black women like to, like, you know, kiki and, you know, laugh and stuff like that. It's just our culture. But you know, the, you know, white boys make little comments about that, I wouldn't sit at the table a lot of times because I just didn't want to, I didn't want the attention to be on me. I didn't want them to be looking at us and whispering and stuff. So I would sit with my other friends who weren't as many black people in that group, or, you know, so there's definitely things that I did that I realized, was me trying to distance myself from my culture, I mean, really what I'm completely like owed and entitled to do and be and experience and, you know, grow into, but I kind of stifled that, you know, growing up. So, going to Howard, definitely, well, the first thing that sort of started to open my eyes a little more was going to visit Howard when I applied and I got accepted, and being immersed instead of in a completely white academic environment, being completely immersed in a predominantly black academic environment and seeing what that looked like and what that felt like. I mean, long story short, I just realized this is something that I want to embrace, that I need to embrace, you know? So that's sort of where the switch happened for me. I mean, there's, of course, other things down the line, because I was always proud of my blackness. I was always resistant of, you know, falling victim to self-hatred and things like that. But once I went to Howard and I saw what the environment was like there, I was like, this is what I need to do to unlearn all that bullshit.
Yeah.
I know it's in my subconscious. I know it's back there. You know, like I gotta unpack it, and I know I can't do that at PWI, so I have to go to this HBCU. I have to, and that's why I went to Howard. So I really think that was like that switch for me. What about you?
So growing up, I went to public school, so they were mostly like racially diverse. I feel like my high school was what, like, almost half black people, or at least black and brown people. There's a good amount of diversity in the schools that I went to in identity, but that doesn't, of course, account for the power structure. And something that always happened is that, and it wasn't by accident, like, my parents, with how they raised me and my siblings, we were able to access certain spaces. Like, we were always in the gifted programs or the whatever else. And all of that stuff is a scam. Probably have an episode on that. But anyways, but when I would be in the AP class, when I would be in the gifted class, there would only be one or two other black people in that class. Mm-hmm. And so kind of my experience was always like, it's similar to yours, where it's like, you don't want all of that attention to be on you. And like, The other black kid in the class, it was like me and this other black guy in a lot of the classes from middle to high school. And he kind of like resorted to like making, like kind of doing like is minstrel too strong? He would do, like, he would perform his blackness in a way that was humorous to white people to gain like social advantages. And I didn't feel like I was good enough at doing that, even if I wanted to do it. And it made me uncomfortable when I would try to do it. So I kind of like, it just left me feeling more ostracized. And then I felt like I couldn't even properly connect with the other black person because he was like so deep in his performance, at least how I perceived it. And so it was just like, it was even more.
The coon chip had been activated.
It's like sad because you're just trying, like you said, you really, at that age, I mean, really at any age, you just want community. And I feel like you just want friends, you know what I mean? And it's like, I just feel like there was a lot of frustration with growing up with like realizing that certain things were advantageous to me. Like, I noticed when I was very, very young, if I spoke a certain way, if I read a certain book, like I talked about reading Harry Potter, I read some big book like that, the white people would respond to it in a certain way and it would give me favors. Like, I noticed that very, very early on. And I just, it felt grimy at a very, like, I just realized how much of it is inauthentic, and like that, like my peers, like they were giving me chances because they thought I was so special, but all of my other peers could do with what I was doing too, but they just, they weren't signaling to the white people properly that they were one of the special blacks. And I just thought this concept, as I went through high school, this concept of trying to vie for the respect and attention of the white power structure and the people who are the gatekeepers in it, is just, it's a humiliating and destructive process. Like, I did not feel good for most of that grade school experience, even though I was being rewarded with so many things. Like, I was getting, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was reaching certain mm-hmm. milestones. It was working in that regards, but like, I just felt like I was more than separating from my blackness. I feel like I was being separated from myself, like spiritually, to be a little woohoo, you know? Mm-hmm. But like, kind of the shift, I think one of the biggest shifts, there were several, is, well, there was Trayvon Martin. That was really, really big with how my school responded to that. That was really mine big. That was, yeah, but I think in a more, something that had to intimately do with me is that I was the student council president when I was a junior, and they had this uniform policy at my school. And I was just against it because I wanted, you know, free expression. I wanted to be able to wear what I wanted to. I wanted my peers to be able to, you know, I didn't want us to all look the same. And it was more from it wasn't like a deep critique. It was just like, I wanted us to be able to express ourselves. And so I got called in by the administration at my school, and they were telling all of the people in student council that they wanted us to do this commercial. Like, they wanted us to promote and basically make a case for the uniforms. And I was like, oh, I don't agree with the uniforms, so I'm not going to do that. And then the person who was in charge told me that, like, the real reason that they're instituting the uniforms is so that the black kids, because it was a majority black school, there was another school that was underfunded and wasn't, it was a whole another story. But the other school in my district, that school was getting overcrowded, and those kids were going to have to start going to other places. And they wanted to do something to make sure that they didn't come here. And this was part of that strategy. And she said that to me as if that was supposed to be, like, convincing. Like, that was supposed to, like, I was going to be so afraid of those scary black kids from the other school coming that I would betray my own principles. And what? I just, that was a lot for me to unpack, because it was like, one, so how did you think, it's so messed up, but it's like, one, how did you think that it was okay to say that to me? Like, it just made me reevaluate kind of how I was navigating my relationships with white people.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It's you, because you really, you learn to be deferential. You learn to create space, not for everybody. Black people very rarely were people modeling creating space for black people, especially undesirable, poor black people, queer black people who are even further in the margins of blackness, which is already marginalized. Like, no, you don't create space for them. But when it comes to white people who haven't read and don't understand the history of this country, and them saying whatever they want to, that you need to act with grace, and you need to think about their background and their humanity. And you just, there's this this pedestal that you're expected to put the perspective specifically of white people on, that it's just like, I feel like it's, that's, I'm very troubled by the open-minded, like, yeah. In theory, I get it, and I think I agree with it, but, like, in execution, it's so messy because of the power dynamics. I was a political science major, so I'm going to talk about power a lot, probably. I apologize in advance, but, like, the power dynamics is completely out of whack, and, like, right now, there are people who are in control. There are people, there is a certain narrative that is dominant, and so I don't feel the need right now in my journey, and kind of like in creating this podcast and everything we're trying to do, I don't feel the need anymore to try to understand white supremacy. A joke I would always say is like I feel like I get white supremacy at this point. Like, there's only so many ways you can remix it. Like, I'm good now. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, there's no perspective that a white person, or a way of a white person can package white supremacy that's gonna, like, you know, oh,
yeah, and there's
that way,
and there's no need to, there's no need to make space for it, because it's a fucking parasite. It's a pandemic.
It doesn't, you know, work. It doesn't work. And so, yeah. So we're here now. We're past kind of like, you know, I feel like a lots of Black people, rather you were at, like my friend, like you were at a all-white school, or you went to a mixed school like me, or you went to all-Black school, I feel like we all, or even if you're an immigrant, you're a Black immigrant, and you're from a country where you went to school with nothing but Black people, but like that specter of white supremacy is global. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like, it's always trying to get us to separate from ourselves. It's always trying to get us to not tap into that power that is innate to us that we already have.
For sure.
And so, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think we really realized there's a lot of power in the word ghetto, and mm-hmm. it shouldn't be something that we are ashamed of, run from, or avoid. This podcast is really a reclamation of the word ghetto. That's what it is. Think about it. I think you could think about it as like the same way that the Black community has reclaimed the word nigga. I think you could think about it that way. There's debate, you know, in some circles about whether or not we should still be using the word nigga, but for better or worse, a majority of Black people do. Is it a majority? It's a lot, you know?
I think it's a majority.
Yeah, it really is.
But if you're talking African-American, yes.
Yeah. Most of us probably use the word nigga. Some people feel like we shouldn't use it because of the history of the word. But ultimately, if you look at, you know, the way that we've used it to sort of create camaraderie and community and just be creative with, I mean, honestly, it's like we were creative with the word. We took like this horrible slur that was meant to demonize us and relegate us to second class citizens, and we turned it into like same thing as saying, oh, that's the homie. Like, that's great. I mean, honestly, that's absolute ghetto. That's like, that's Black ingenuity. That's
yes. Black creativity. Yes.
And we took that ER off and we put the E A, and we said the A sounds a little bit softer. It sounds a little more cute. That's what we're going to go with. We're going to cut that ER. That's a little too harsh. And we're going to put that A. That's Black creativity. That's Black ingenuity. That's AABE. That is so much of what we're getting at here. So I feel like this podcast is a reclamation of the word ghetto. And we just wanted to, like, be super extra and call it the absolute ghetto, because we just want to celebrate, our Blackness, and
like, we're not in all of its glory. Yeah, because yeah, so, it's like, it's so long, like, I just feel like so many people, that stifled feeling, I feel like so many people can relate to that, you know what I mean, of let me turn this off, code switching is this whole, you know, phenomenon. you know, that people talk about all the time and study. And it's like, let's just have something that's for us and by us. Let's just have something that where we are going to center ourselves for once. We're not going to be thinking about how white people are responding to this. We're not going to be, oh, we don't want to scare white people, or, oh, we don't want to offend white people. We are going to be doing something that celebrates who we are and gives us the space, because we have so much work to do. You know what I mean? There's not, like, Blackness is not monolithic, and it's not simple. There's like a lot of nuances to our culture, and to especially the diaspora, and how the diaspora intersects with each other and also differs with each other. And so, I don't want to spend any more time thinking about like how our relationship to white people. That's at least in this space right now. We're not going to do that anymore.
So I think there's something that we need to address. The first time that I used the word or the phrase, the absolute ghetto.
Oh, right.
Because it was me. You honestly tell the story better than I do, even though it was me, so you say it.
So we had went to, I'm in Illinois now, but we had went down to Atlanta together to visit some friends and family. And one of my best friends, she was joking with us, and she was like, Sade was like, can we get, I need some water. And my friend's like, we don't got water. We don't have water in our house. And she was like, and then Sade, my friend was like, no, I'm joking. And Sade was like, I was about to say the absolute. And it's just like, we don't got water in there. Like, and it's funny, because like, we kind of already were having these conversations about like, reclaiming certain things and like unpacking what words means and all that type of thing. And it was just funny, kind of that reflex that we both had. Like, she said it and everyone like was cackling and laughing all hard.
It's just a reflex. Honestly, it's kind of like a joke. And I feel like it's kind of like I'm just saying, like, the word nigga. Like, I feel like I can use it because, okay. So what I will say is that I feel like you don't necessarily have to have grown up in what is considered like the ghetto, the hood, to still feel like a connection to the word ghetto or feel like you have some sort of stake in that word just because you're Black. Because I feel like the word ghetto has been used and weaponized against Black people regardless of their class status or how they grew up or how they present themselves. You know, things like your hair, the way you dress, the way you talk, things like that can all be considered ghetto without you having like grown up necessarily in an environment that's considered the ghetto. You know what I mean? Like, I've definitely had the word ghetto used in a negative way towards me, you know, because of like the way I wear my hair, for example, you know, even if it's just braids and they're neat. And
because the demonization of Blackness is not geographically specific at all. Exactly. Kind of like we were talking about with the vacation example. Like, it's just wherever Black people are is kind of where it's considered to be inferior. Because the underlying assumption is that Black people and anything that they produce is inferior. So it's like, that's kind of, to me, I feel like Black people, it's funny because we do have class division, for sure. But like, I feel like that's, we actually have way more in common with each other as far as like white people are willing to discard us at any time. I mean, look at what happened with Herman Cain. You know, rest in peace. I don't like people dying, even if I disagree with them. But like, that man was bending over backwards for white supremacy. He was doing so much to his dying breath, and he just gets a passing mention. They move on as if nothing happened. He was not valuable to them. They did not care about him. They did not afford him all of the efforts that he made in distancing himself from his Blackness and demonizing other Black people. It did not give him the upward mobility that I think he was ultimately seeking. And I feel like that's why, to me, first of all, like that white supremacist power structure is parasitic. Like you said, to everybody, including the white people, it's destructive to them too. And so it's not something, as a Black person, I don't really feel the need to have to go near that. Like, being Black and the quote-unquote ghetto is my birthright. You know what I mean? It's something that I was born in. It's something that we all already have. We can choose to distance ourselves from it. But, like, we all... You see it with Black people. Like, even when they try to act all bougie and they don't know what's going on, you play a certain song, you know what I mean? You do something, and that there's a switch, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We all have it.
The ghetto jumps out. Way. No, I'm kidding. But for real... And it's a good thing. And it's a good thing.
No, it's like, it's a beautiful thing. And so,
yeah. All right.
I hope y'all know what the show is, what we're trying to do at least at this point.
Yeah. I think we were a little bit long-winded. So sorry about that. If you're still here listening, shout out to you. You don't win anything, but we love you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That pause.
Kind of in the nature of celebrating Blackness, I kind of wanted to create a forum where people, you know, who choose to listen to this show could kind of submit any questions that they have or comments, and we could kind of create the space for dialogue. I will work this out. Maybe it could be a Discord or something like that, where we're able to kind of have our ideas interact with each other, because that's one of the beautiful things about Blackness, especially we talked a lot about the music, and both in hip hop and jazz. It's like that referential part of, like, you know, when you're improvising a solo, you are gonna like reference certain motifs. You know what I mean? Like, it's in conversation. You're also in conversation with the bass player and the piano player, like your rhythm section. And I know a similar element happens in hip hop too. And so I kind of want us to have that spirit here where our ideas are able to be sharpened, and we are able to have the space where basically like Black ingenuity is being facilitated in like a affirmative supportive space. And so, yes, more details to come on that.
That's an amazing idea. That sounds really beautiful. I'm excited for that. And just to finish up, I wanted to shout out an organization that is celebrating Black ingenuity. And we're going to shout out Black orgs at the end of all of our episodes. So today's Black organization that we're shouting out is called the Black Innovation Alliance. Their mission is to increase Black ownership and shrink the racial wealth gap. They actually just launched on June 30th of this year, 2020, and they're focused on advancing Black people beyond like the NAACP and the United Negro College Fund, and looking for ways to support Black innovators. And we think that's a perfect organization to shout out for this episode. Shout out to Black Innovation Alliance.
Yes.
A link to check them out will be in the show notes. So check them out.
Yes, please do. And we really appreciate what the folks over there are doing.
So we hope you enjoyed the first episode. This is our first time having a podcast, and me and Malcolm have been best friends for a minute now. We met at Howard, as I think we told you. If you don't know, we met at Howard, and we've been, we've been such good friends ever since, and we always have talks. We both were in Chicago together for a minute before I just moved back to Atlanta, but we would always talk like either in person or on the phone for hours about, you know, always complicated, nuanced topics involving Blackness and identity and capitalism, because it always comes back to capitalism. So
it always comes back to fucking capitalism.
So we decided that, like,
for imperialism too.
Oh, yeah. And we decided that we were having some really interesting conversations that were helping us to grow as people, and we wanted to share it with the world. So this is our attempt at doing so. We really appreciate your support. And thank you so much for listening to our first episode. We love you guys.
Love y'all. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.